This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Well, not long ago, vast tracts of the Russian subarctic were covered in permafrost. That has now turned into wet bogland, the result of global climate change, which is creating significant problems for industry in the area.
And at that point, it's completely out of our control, and in the sense that even if the humans stopped emitting more greenhouse gases, the release of the trapped carbon material in the tundra just runs away.
We know that with warming and Arctic amplification, that we expect the largest warming in the world to be right where the largest stock of temperature-sensitive carbon is. So it's sort of an obvious question. What kind of feedbacks can we expect there? You end up with somewhere in the range of 60 to 80% permafrost loss by 2100.
Gas pipelines in Siberia are rising right out of the ground, while in Alaska, oil pipelines sag. Houses and factories built on permafrost are tipping. Evergreens are slanting in so-called drunken forests. Under the whole North, land is becoming unstable as the climate warms. I'm Alex Smith. We're going to find many answers to a simple question. What happens if the permafrost thaws? I attended a conference session on that very subject with expert scientists at this year's meeting of the American Academy for the Advancement of Science. We'll hear the latest. But it was rough going. After the session, which was technical and carefully hedged with scientific doubts, I ran into the soil expert for the European Union, Luca Montanarella. I told him, in spite of all I'd heard, I still didn't know, should we be worried or not? You'd like to worry, wouldn't you? Luca replied. But we have many more things to worry about now, further south. Of course, Luca is Italian. There were riots in the streets of Italy. The government had fallen and the banking system might soon follow. In the course of preparing this program on permafrost, I ran into as many opinions as experts. The permafrost may thaw over hundreds of years. The carbon stored there will come out slowly, one said. Another suggested that when the thaw comes, it will already be too late for our civilization, ruined by a changed climate further south. Other scenarios predict 50 to 80% of permafrost will thaw during this century. Maybe the released greenhouse gases will only equal 10 or 20 years of our current emissions, one of our guests says. Only. Another brand new scientific paper suggests permafrost melt may have caused the greatest mass extinction of 55 million years ago. We've never seen it. The frost was supposed to be permanent and has been during all our human time on Earth. Now the signs of big changes are around the Arctic. What is coming? We can only model the future with very imperfect tools and guess the rest. Before we go into our interview with Canadian scientist Antony Lefkovitz, let's tune up with this short clip from the BBC.
Well, not long ago, vast tracts of the Russian subarctic were covered in permafrost. That has now turned into wet bogland, the result of global climate change, which is creating significant problems for industry in the area. Oleg Boldarev joined a scientific expedition in western Siberia to see the problem at first hand.
Looking for hard data in very soft ground. A researcher walks over a swamp to collect samples of lake water in the tundra laying above Russian permafrost. There are more and more of such swamps and lakes. And here is what worries scientists most. Methane, a greenhouse gas 20 times more powerful than CO2. The bubbles may be small, but the new lakes are emerging everywhere. Satellite images show the formation of new lakes. On the ground, samples need to be taken from lakes of different size and age. Dark, peaty water in this baby lake warms up under the sun, and so the melting begins.
Well, this is how it starts. The shallow depression in the ground is the beginning of a new lake, the lake which will be growing. And as it grows, it will release more and more methane. The same thing happens all over western Siberia. Now, 60% of Russian area is covered by permafrost, and the amounts of methane which are now stored locked underneath the surface are said to be around 80 billion tons.
Opinions differ on how much gas escapes each year, but it's a spiraling process. Once in the sky, methane aggravates global warming, and so even bigger areas of tundra get covered by lakes. All this may mean bad news for Russia's main industry. Underneath this seemingly untouched land run huge gas pipelines. And here's one of them, pushed onto the surface by shifting, unstable ground. Unofficially, there is talk of increasing accidents like this, though on the record, Russia's Gazprom says its operations are not affected. But according to some researchers, the best-case scenario means simply having enough time to adapt to the new environment.
It's taking place now, and we are too late, to my mind, with decision-making, because this process was started, and now we have not any opportunity to stop it. We have only a time to delay it, maybe, to make the results less horrible.
70 years ago, cities and industries of the Russian north were literally drilled into permafrost. Back then, things indeed seemed permanent. But now this wobbly ground may become a symbol of new, unpredictable climate conditions for the world's largest country. Oleg Boldarev, BBC News.
I think before we dive into expert-level testimony about the latest science, let's start with a more user-friendly Radio EcoShock interview.
Radio EcoShock.
When we think about planet Earth, we don't picture a frozen planet. But a huge area underground is always icy. We call it permafrost. You won't find it in your backyard unless you live in the far north. Geologists and other scientists have only begun the task of cataloging this vast underground world. Now, as Earth warms, we all need to know about it, because if all the carbon locked up in the north is released, our climate and maybe even our civilization will change beyond recognition. Professor Antony Levkovich is a central figure unraveling this mystery. From the Department of Geography at Canada's University of Ottawa, Levkovich studies, leads doctoral researchers, and advises international groups on permafrost. He's a co-author on a new paper on the impacts of climate change on permafrost in Canada. Tony, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
Well, you study places that are lightly inhabited, few people are around, it's seldom covered in the news we get every day. Before we get to your new scientific paper, I have to ask you, why should the public care what happens to the permafrost?
Well, I guess there are three reasons. The first thing is that permafrost can be a good thermometer. So unlike climate, which we register in the air, so when we register air temperatures over the long term, of course we get big year-to-year fluctuations. But if you go a little bit further into the Earth, you get a much longer-term signal without those fluctuations. So permafrost can act as the proverbial canary in the coal mine, indicating that indeed the North is warming. And, you know, sometimes in recent years there's been some controversy about whether climate change is really happening. And I would put it to you that permafrost doesn't know how to lie. It's not in big cities. It's not being affected by urbanization. It's not being affected by agricultural change. And so when permafrost says the climate's warming, it's got to be telling the truth. So that's my first point. The second one is that, as you pointed out, the carbon issue, that's really going to affect people all over the world. Really, the jury is out at this point to know whether there is going to be large emissions of carbon into the atmosphere. We do know, and we have learned just in the last few years, that there are massive, massive stocks of carbon locked up in the permafrost. But how long it'll take to thaw is another big question, and that's something we may want to come back to later. And the third point is it costs you. At least in Canada, where we have a federal government, that federal government is putting lots of money into the northern territories, the Yukon, the Northwest Territories, and Nunavut. And some of that money is going to stop permafrost thaw or to deal with the effects of permafrost thaw. There's a section of the Alaska Highway going through the Yukon to Alaska itself, which in fact the U.S. government has put a lot of money into too, to keep the highway up. And if you're within about 100 kilometers of the border with Alaska, you'll go through a series of ups and downs and lefts and rights on that road that are being caused by the permafrost beneath it thawing out. And it's costing tens of millions of dollars each year to upkeep that road.
Yes, well, we've got whole villages and towns built right on this ground that's presumed to be frozen. We've got pipelines crossing it that may be going up and down. Can you talk to us about that?
Sure. As you say, coastal erosion is a big problem, particularly in Alaska, but we think it might become more of a problem. Most of the settlements are on the coasts in Canada as well, and so we've got Tuktoyaktuk is a problem of coastal erosion. And all around the northern coast of the Beaufort Sea and into the Bering Straits, you've got problems of erosion in Alaska. Whereas you say villages which were built on the coast because the First Nation peoples or the local inhabitants were dependent largely on fishing, and now we've got major, major rates of coastal erosion taking place. Sometimes it's difficult for us to tease out whether really things are accelerating or whether they've always been going on like that. But it's pretty obvious that if we have a longer ice-free season in the Arctic Ocean, that overall we're likely to get bigger wave, more storminess. All of those things are predicted anyway under climate change. And so you get more erosion. And the soil, because it gets washed away by a combination of wave action and thawing, just as the, if you imagine a block of ice with soil suspended in it thawing, well, there isn't much left after you've thawed it. And that's the kind of thing that's happening, which can lead to rates of erosion of, you know, tens of meters a year in some cases. So even if you had your house, you know, back a few hundred meters from the coast, as if it gets eaten away at tens of meters a year, it does tend to focus your mind on issues of coastal erosion.
Right. And how deep does this frozen soil, how deep does the frozen ground go, and how long has the plant material been building up in that?
It's very variable. If you go to the far north of Canada, and that's one of the things that's in our paper, is it compares across the different conditions in permafrost. So in the far northern tip of Canada at Alert on Ellesmere Island, the permafrost is several hundred meters thick, probably 500 to 700 meters in thickness. And its temperature is at about minus 15. But if you go south from there, the permafrost gets warmer and it gets thinner. And in the far north, it's continuous. So it's everywhere under every part of the landscape. And as you go south, as it gets warmer and thinner, it begins to break up. So if you like, it's like a jigsaw puzzle in the south. We're missing a whole bunch of pieces as you're putting it together, whereas in the north, the picture is complete. And similarly, it's thick in the north and thinner in the south. So in some parts of permafrost, the organic material has been accumulating for thousands of years. That's particularly true in parts of Alaska that weren't glaciated in the last glaciation, which ended about 10,000 years ago or so. And so for hundreds of thousands of years, we had slow buildup of aeolian material, windblown material on the surface, and then the grass kind of grew through that and stabilized it. And then as that surface gradually rose through many, many years, the permafrost, which was down at a depth of about 70 or 80 centimeters, rose with it. So it gradually incorporated that material that was being buried at the surface, went into the permafrost. And through time, that organic material was then preserved, just like in your freezer. You've got food in there that's carbon that's being preserved by the cold temperatures. And so in parts of Alaska and Yukon for many, many tens of thousands of years, and similarly in large parts of Russia, that's the case as well, because it was so dry during the last glaciation in those areas that there were no glaciers. Instead, it was a steppe landscape, a landscape with the woolly mammoth and all those great things that the great quaternary Pleistocene animals that roamed around in the Arctic 100,000 years ago.
We're talking with Professor Tony Levkovich, and I'd like to get down to your paper that was published in the Canadian Journal of Earth Sciences, also known as CJES. Please tell us the title of the paper and maybe just a very brief bit about your co-authors.
Well, the paper is called Climate and Ground Temperature Relations at Sites Across the Continuous and Discontinuous Permafrost Zones in Northern Canada. And my co-authors are Jennifer Troop and Sharon Smith. And Jennifer Troop is a former graduate student of mine. In fact, she was co-supervised, a master's student, with Sharon Smith, who is at the Geological Survey of Canada. And Sharon, for many, many years, has been taking readings across Canada in terms of her work for the Geological Survey. And Jenny then came and worked with the two of us in Ottawa for a couple of years during the International Polar Year, which ended in 2009. And as part of that, we developed and put in new boreholes to measure permafrost temperatures. And then we were able to use as well the long-term boreholes that have been maintained by the Geological Survey to put together a paper that really looked across all the permafrost zones.
And what were some of the conclusions you reached?
Well, I guess the first thing was the most obvious one, which was that permafrost is really climatically dominated at the scale of the continent. So what I described earlier, how it's so cold in the north and so much warmer in the south, really came out in this project. So we have ground temperatures that literally minus 15 up to just fractionally below zero. So we have some permafrost that's nearly gone or is perhaps in the process of going, and everything in between. And it's very rare to have all of those data in a single paper because mostly people work in a given geographical area. And this way we were able to, through putting together a lot of information over acquired over many years and at huge cost, as you can imagine, we were able to get a picture sort of across the continent.
Well, you know, I've been following some of the reports of melting permafrost in Siberia, too. There's a fascinating video on YouTube of thousands of new shallow lakes, some small, some large, that are just popping up across northern Russia. You can even see them from space or on Google Earth. Is the same thing happening in Canada and Alaska?
I don't think it's happening to the same scale as in Russia at this point. We do have very strong warming, particularly in the Mackenzie Valley, of the western part of northern Canada. Where we see temperatures increasing by even as much as a degree Celsius in a decade. And we are seeing in the southern fringes there places where peatlands in particular, where there is permafrost present in the peat and then not in the adjacent small ponds, some of these peatlands are decaying relatively rapidly. And again, you can see that through looking at satellite photos or air photos taken over decades or years. But the idea of large numbers of ponds being created in a short time, it doesn't seem to be happening yet in North America. And it's not absolutely clear why that is the case, but we don't seem to have quite the same level of impacts. But we are certainly seeing changes through time. We, as part of the International Polar Year, we redid a survey along the Alaska Highway from Whitehorse down into northern British Columbia. And this is a zone of permafrost that we call the discontinuous zone, so it's only present under certain parts of the landscape. And in fact, it's the warmest part of the discontinuous zone. So in fact, it's probably present in maybe less than 10% of the landscape. And the other 90% is just like your backyard in southern Canada or the United States. So in other words, the ground is frozen in the winter, but thaws all the way through in the summertime. In this part of the territory, we were able to show that comparing a survey that was done in 1964, that about half the sites that were found in 1964, when even then there wouldn't have been that much permafrost around, but half of those sites no longer have permafrost. And so we're able to see that over multi-decades anyway, there have been significant changes to the distribution of permafrost in that southern fringe. On the other hand, if we go all the way up to Alert, the northernmost point in Canada, the permafrost today is at minus 14 or minus 15, and a decade ago or several decades ago, perhaps it was a degree colder, slightly colder than it is today. So what we're seeing there is not thawing, it just has warmed slightly. And so that's the kind of different impacts that we expect to see across the permafrost world. If you take your frozen turkey and you turn up the temperature on your freezer by 1 degree, the turkey is still frozen. Because it's at minus 15 and it's gone to minus 14. But if you take that turkey out and put it on the side of on your kitchen counter, you know it's not going to stay frozen for all that long.
Right. Parts of it will stay frozen for a while on the inside, but the outside's melting.
That's right. And actually, the fact that it does take a while to melt to thaw is an important point. And I'm going to use some science speak now just to correct one of your uses there. We like to say thaw, not melt. As somebody said to me, if you thaw your turkey, you still have it to eat. If you melt your turkey, there's nothing left to eat. So we use thaw rather than melt because melt refers to only the ice, and permafrost doesn't necessarily have ice in it. It can just be made of rock with no water in it at all. Permafrost is defined by the temperature, so it has to be below zero for 2 or more years. But apart from that, we can go from everything from nearly pure ice right the way through to pure rock, and we definitely don't melt the rock.
I definitely did not know that. So what are some of the factors which determine the amount of greenhouse gases that come out as the permafrost thaws?
I was last week I was at a conference, and a post International Polia Conference in Montreal, and I attended a number of sessions that were looking at carbon and permafrost and carbon emissions in general. This is the hot topic right now in permafrost research, and it's partly the hot topic because we don't have firm answers yet. As I said earlier, we know we have lots of carbon there. How much is going to be released and how fast it will be released is the key question. So what my understanding of all this is that when you have carbon without water, so you have aerobic conditions, basically that carbon will break down and release carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. If you have anaerobic conditions in which you have a wetland, a flooded area, then what you will release is potentially a combination of carbon dioxide and methane. And methane is a much more powerful greenhouse gas, that's CH4, than carbon dioxide. So a big question for us that is yet unanswered is what proportion of methane will be released versus the proportion of carbon dioxide? And it's difficult to answer that because that depends partly on what happens to the landscape. You talked earlier about ponds. So generally speaking, when we have water bodies, we will get methane released. But if we just get a drier type landscape, we may get carbon dioxide released. So on the one hand, it's that partitioning between carbon dioxide and methane that is unclear but is crucial. And the second part is really how fast will it happen? And that also depends partly on water. Water is a pretty efficient transmitter of heat down into the ground. So if we start to get a pond, then it tends to transmit the heat into the surrounding area, which then again begins to thaw. The ice melts. And if the ice melts, well, that landscape's going to collapse because there's no longer anything supporting the soil particles. So a pond can grow through time, as you described. So we could sort of get a feedback effect in which the initial formation of a pond creates a larger pond, creates a larger pond, creates a larger pond. And each time that happens, or as that's happening progressively, we're getting methane released. On the other hand, in other sites, maybe we'll just get a slow settlement of the ground surface, no ponding, and a slightly deeper thawed layer during the summertime, which means that some of that carbon may get released as carbon dioxide and may have a much more limited impact. So I don't think we have the answer yet, but what we know is it's a really, really serious question.
Right. So we've got how much is there, what form will it take as it comes out, and then how fast will it come out? And that is a huge question for many of us. I mean, we were told that the Arctic sea ice would remain solid until the year 2100, and now we have predictions of an open Arctic sea in September, at least as early as 2015. We don't know. But I'm wondering, is that same fear of speed up happening with the permafrost thawing?
I think we do have that concern. I don't think there's really a tipping point because that sort of implies that after this moment everything goes belly up. But I think we do think that the possibility of accelerated change is a real one. We know that permafrost is thawing, and we've got evidence of that I just mentioned earlier. And there are other studies around the Arctic, similar to the kind that we've done, that shows that permafrost is disappearing. We know there's lots of carbon. So by definition, that carbon must be becoming more available to the atmosphere. But how fast it will happen, still, as I said, we're not absolutely sure. But because it's positive feedback, just like the Arctic ice is positive feedback, as the ice goes on the ocean, so we get more energy absorbed, so then the ice goes faster. And permafrost has the potential to do that, that if we get a warming planet, as we continue to warm the planet, I should say, the permafrost itself will begin to thaw faster, and that could release more carbon to the atmosphere, which in turn will cause the warming to accelerate. And I think there's another very important point, which is a bit like the Arctic sea ice. It's difficult to imagine how we can revert back to a previous condition. It's actually quite difficult to thaw ground, but it's also very difficult to freeze ground. So if we have ice that's present in the permafrost and we have a raised peatland where right now most of the peat, which is, you know, organic matter, is locked up in that frozen soil, once we thaw it, I don't know how we're going to freeze it again. So I do see that very much as a one-way ticket. So once we start on it, I can't see how we can really stop it.
Right. There isn't a geoengineering solution for that one.
Not that I can think of. I did have somebody write to me once and said drop a whole bunch of thermosiphons which extract heat from the ground and drop them all over the tundra. He wanted a sort of forest of thermosiphons. But that isn't going to work because all you do is pump energy into the air.
We're talking with Professor Anthony Levkovich from the Department of Geography at the University of Ottawa. You know, I attended a three-lecture workshop on permafrost at the latest meeting of the American Academy for the Advancement of Science, and I came away with the impression that the whole subject is still in its infancy. Would you say that's true? And if so, what do we need to focus on first?
I don't think permafrost is really in its infancy, because we've had studies that go right back to the 19th century. The first permafrost work was done in Russia in the 19th century when they were drilling holes to try and look at it. And in fact, we also know a lot about it. The miners in the Klondike, in the gold rush in the Yukon in 1898, also had to deal with permafrost. And they discovered how to deal with it. They thawed their way down through it with fires. They deforested the entire landscape in order to create pits that they could go down through the permafrost to reach the frozen gravels underneath that had the gold in it. So people have been coping with permafrost for a long time. However, what I can tell you is that when I was a graduate student about 30 years ago, there wasn't a huge amount of interest in permafrost. And there was because of resources in the north, but over the following 15 years or so, fewer and fewer people seem to be interested. But in the last 15 years, there's been a huge uptick in interest for the kind of reasons that we've been talking about already. The problem is we don't necessarily have the people, in North America at least, who really have worked their careers on permafrost, who have supervised graduate students. And so we have a bit of a knowledge gap there, and it's largely through changes through time that society has become more interested in the subject as a result of global warming and as a result of the changes we're seeing in the Arctic. But if we go back 20 years, I would have been hard-pressed to have a radio interview.
Right, and can you tell us, have you seen some good research? Who would you recommend coming from the Russians or the Europeans or other places on this subject?
Well, the Russians have a great deal of experience, but not a huge amount of money to put into it. What's happened, however, is that they've exported some of their best scientists to the U.S., and, for example, Vladimir Romanovsky, who is at University of Alaska Fairbanks, is one of the top permafrost researchers globally. Nikolai Shiklomanov, who is at George Brown University, is a mid-career scientist who's also making waves. So what we've actually seen is that the Russians, who really have get up and go, have become Americans.
I understand. Well, what do you personally find the most interesting about permafrost?
That's kind of an odd question, I suppose, because for me it's been something I've been working on for many, many years. I think it's the following. In theory, permafrost should be a very simple process and system to understand. It's purely driven by energy fluxes, energy in, energy out. So you'd think that we'd understand it by now. It's not a very complex system at the energy level, but it turns out that at the landscape level, it's incredibly complex, and we still don't fully understand what's going to happen to the future of it, as we've said many times. I can go to a site in the Yukon, and I could probably tell you 9 times out of 10 whether there's permafrost present at that site just by looking at it, looking at the vegetation that grows there, looking at where it is in terms of elevation, looking at whether there's water present and what the soils look like without even digging a pit. Probably 9 times out of 10. But if you ask me to predict that from remote sensing, from a satellite image, I'll probably be wrong most of the time. So our brains are actually pretty good at assessing conditions, but for some reason we're not able to transmit that yet into reliable methods that can work from space, unlike glaciers or sea ice. And we're still not able to predict the future of it in the long run with a high degree of confidence at the landscape level. We can often do a pretty good job at the individual site, but not telling you what's going to happen all the way across the north.
Well, that's a challenge. And I guess you've heard scientist Rob DeCanto just published an article in the journal Nature suggesting melting permafrost may have caused the great mass extinction around 55 million years ago. What did you think of that?
Well, I certainly read that with interest, but that was taking the global scale definitely for permafrost. So I don't feel competent really to discuss the actual science that's in that paper, but it certainly, again, it comes back to, is there the potential for this risk at the global scale so that people ask me, well, is there still going to be permafrost left? And of course, the answer is there's going to be permafrost throughout our lifetimes. The question is how much will be left and what the impacts of the stuff that's thawing is going to have. And I think those ones we're still not sure of.
We've been talking with Professor Antony Lefkovic from the Department of Geography at the University of Ottawa. He's at the hub of Canadian research into permafrost. His latest paper, published in the Canadian Journal of Earth Sciences, describes the impact of climate change on this giant storehouse of carbon. And you can find more links at my blog at ecoshock.info. Thank you so much, Tony, for helping us out.
It's been a great pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock will be right back with more.
When it's really, 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 really hot, and it's July and January, and there's no more snow, and huge waves are wiping out cities, and hurricanes are everywhere, and everyone knows it's a problem. But if some of the experts say it's no problem, and if other experts claim it's no problem, or explain why it's no problem, then it's simply not a problem.
Many scientists believe global warming is causing permafrost thaw, releasing huge amounts of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, which in turn speeds up global warming. When permafrost melts, huge deposits of organic substances that have been frozen for tens of thousands of years decompose, potentially releasing enormous amounts of methane and carbon dioxide gas. According to the UN, methane is 25 times more potent than carbon dioxide over a 100-year period. And Russia, which is 60% covered by permafrost, most likely holds the biggest methane threat in the world.
Нужно заключить новое международное соглашение, по которому мы бы гарантировали, что парниковые эмиссии, которые ведут к глобальному изменению климата, были бы снижены, минимизированы. И тогда мы как минимум затормозим те негативные процессы, которые происходят в том числе в российской Арктике.
You just heard a short clip from Laurie Anderson and from a Greenpeace YouTube video on permafrost. Our theme music this week is from Laurie Anderson's latest album, We Need the Experts, and
only an expert can deal with the problem. So if there's no expert dealing with the problem, it's really actually twice the problem. Because only an expert can deal with the problem. Only an expert can deal with the problem.
The big question for this program and for the world is, what if the permafrost thaws? I was unable to find a figure for the exact amount of world soil and rock that is frozen. The BBC clip we ran earlier claimed 60% of Russia is permanently frozen ground. There is some permafrost in the Andes of Chile and other high mountains, but most is obviously in Russia, Canada, and Alaska. The United States Permafrost Association estimates about 25% of Earth's surface is frozen. Did you know that? And permafrost may account for up to 40% of all soils on the planet. As you heard from Dr. Lefkovitz, interest in these frozen northern soils and rocks dropped until scientists began to calculate a carbon budget for the world. The Wikipedia entry, which is still under construction, says this, quote, "The most recent work investigating the permafrost carbon pool size estimates that 1,400 to 1,700 gigatons of carbon is stored in permafrost soils worldwide. This large carbon pool represents more carbon than currently exists in all living things and twice as much carbon as exists in the atmosphere." Maybe so, but as we'll learn from our next expert, not all of that will reach the atmosphere. And we don't know how long it could take to get there. Dr. Charles Coven is a permafrost and soils expert in the Climate Sciences Department of the Berkeley National Lab in California. Along with the renowned Canadian northern soils expert, Dr. Charles Tarnakai, Dr. Coven was asked to present at the February meeting of the National Academy for the Advancement of Sciences session called What If the Permafrost Thaws? I recorded that session in Vancouver. You can order the whole recording as an MP3 from avon.com as item number 219. I'm going to play you some select audio from the Charles Coven talk. It isn't easy for you and I. First of all, Coven was speaking to experts, not the public. Second, to be frank, neither Coven nor Tarnakai are good public speakers. I think it's too much to ask of our best scientists that they also be master speakers. They spend years in a forbidding field, literally in the cold, and more years working through tedious data in the lab. Their many scientific papers are their voices. So I've selected the best and edited out some of the repetitions and pauses for better radio listening. Before we begin, you'll also need to understand a few phrases and tools used when trying to answer these difficult problems of permafrost. Dr. Lefkowitz gave us a leg up. We found out there is no sharp dividing line on a map where permafrost ends, but fingers and islands jutting out from a completely frozen polar area. There is now a free book called The Soil Atlas of the Circumpolar Region. It's available from the European Union. There are three major soil types in the Arctic, and that matters since each releases more or less carbon when they are exposed to decay. As a group, these are called cryosols, or sometimes gelosols in official soil lingo. Complicating it all, the permafrost can be shallow or very, very deep. You might think that once ancient plant material is buried many feet or meters below the ground, below the reach of living roots, it would stay there. But as anybody in cold winters knows, the soil is always heaving. In the Arctic, with summer surface melt and extreme winter cold, soil layers are tossed about in a process called cryoturbation. Cryoturbation, it's a kind of turbulence of the soil. You'll hear that in Charles Coven's talk. Let's quickly hear from an expert who has risen to a high place.
Let me describe one of the tipping points. There's a tremendous amount of carbon in the frozen tundra in Russia, in Canada, and other places. As the Earth warms up, the microbes in that tundra will begin to wake up, and they will begin to chew on this carbon in the form of dead vegetation and reprocess it in the form of carbon dioxide and methane. Once they begin to do that, scientists say that there will be a release of greenhouse gases that will actually create a runaway effect. And by that I mean that they begin to release more carbon dioxide and methane, it goes up into the atmosphere, there's more greenhouse gases that warms the Earth up still more, and it creates a runaway effect. So much so that there is a reasonable probability that once this starts, the amount of greenhouse gases released could then be larger than, it can even dwarf the amount of greenhouse gases that humans are putting in the air now. And at that point, it's completely out of our control, in the sense that even if the humans stopped emitting more greenhouse gases, the release of the trapped carbon material in the tundra just runs away. We don't know exactly what temperature this is going to occur, but as we go to warmer and warmer temperatures, 4, 5, 6 degrees centigrade, many scientists are feeling that this may really kick in. We cannot go there.
That is Stephen Chu, currently the Secretary of Energy for the United States in the Obama administration. Obviously, he takes thawing permafrost seriously, as should we all. Finally, since we won't know the climate impacts of permafrost thaw until it's much too late, the best we can do is make models from huge masses of scientifically collected data. Talk of complex climate models, woo, that can turn off a lot of radios, I know that. I'm only including a short bit on that subject from Dr. Coven because I think you need to get a feel for what we know and don't know, and how good those guesses are so far. There are at least a dozen serious teams of climate modelers, some running football-sized buildings stuffed full of supercomputers. Everything from weather records, ocean temperatures, chemical formulae, ice formulations, soil types, and even areas of permafrost are fed into these computers. They are trying to forecast what happens if we burn all the oil, coal, and gas, or just some of it. The results, as you know from the periodic reports of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, are divided into possible scenarios with varying levels of confidence. Dr. Coven quickly references the latest models used for the upcoming IPCC assessment, called CEMA for short, it's climate envelope matching. He also talks about RCP level 5, a scenario which is a moderate projection of 500 parts per million of carbon dioxide equivalent in the atmosphere by the year 2100. That's moderate. And the RPC 8.5 scenario, which would take us beyond 4 degrees of warming by 2100. It's a kind of pedal to the metal vision of human greenhouse gas emissions. Hang in there through that modeling talk, and you will be rewarded by some courageous assessments by Dr. Coven of what really happens if the northern lands thaw, plus his surprising and controversial suggestion, which I'm not sure I agree with, that Arctic methane may not be the boogeyman some suggest. Good luck to us all. Here are selections from Charles Koven speaking at the American Academy for the Advancement of Science meeting on February 19, 2012.
There's this enormous amount of carbon, and you know, one of the main reasons that that carbon is there is because it's frozen, right? And so we know that with warming and Arctic amplification, that we expect the largest warming in the world to be right where the largest stock of temperature-sensitive carbon is. So it's sort of an obvious question. What kind of feedbacks can we expect there? But the point here is that there's very high carbon stocks, both in peat soils in Canada and western Siberia, and then also in these highly cryoturbated soils in northern Alaska and in eastern Siberia. We've got similar maps to what Luca was showing with the unfrozen peats, the frozen peats, the non-cryoturbated permafrost soils, which have lower carbon contents, and these highly cryoturbated soils that have higher carbon contents. So one of the tools we have that are available to try and estimate what the magnitude of the feedbacks to climate change are these coupled Earth system models. And so an early intercomparison project of these Earth system models, which is coupled climate, ocean carbon, terrestrial carbon models together, was this Friedenstein et al. C4-MIP intercomparison. And basically, if you look at the terrestrial high-latitude response to warming in these models, the majority of the models show that a net increase in carbon with warming, i.e., you know, with warming you get increased plant productivity. Increased plant productivity means that you're drawing down carbon, and so it actually acts as a negative feedback. But none of these models included any of the processes responsible for the permafrost carbon pool or the existence of this permafrost carbon pool as well. So the question is, what kind of response do you see if you try and incorporate permafrost carbon processes into these Earth system models? The sort of simplest way of thinking about this is, you know, you've got vegetation, and it grows and dies, and as it dies, it decomposes. And so you've got this constant cycling of carbon between the vegetation and the soil that's in the active layer. And then underneath that, you've got this very much slower exchange between the permafrost carbon pool and the actively cycling pool through cryoturbation or dissolved flow of organic carbon. You know, as you move this permafrost table, then you'll be taking a lot of the carbon from this permafrost pool, moving it up to the active layer. And so it's a different dynamic than what you have if you just look at the cycling between the vegetation and the active layer. So there's a couple of different parts of this problem. One is, can we predict the dynamics of the permafrost? And then can we predict the exchange between the carbon in these different pools and in order to get at the response? So the next thing I want to talk about is modeling permafrost within these land surface models. And so, you know, the simplest way to think about this is, so here you've got just temperature as a function of depth, right? And if you imagine a line here for the land surface, and you know, you've got a large seasonal cycle in the atmosphere, and as you go down in depth, that large seasonal cycle attenuates with depth over, you know, some exponential profile. So you've got a, you know, maximum summer temperature and a minimum winter temperature, and you know, this dashed line is kind of a mean temperature, and then this dotted line is 0 degrees. And so, you know, the definition of active layer basically is where this maximum temperature intersects with the 0 degree. That depth defines what the active layer is. And so, you know, if you can imagine, if you slide the whole thing to the right, well, that depth will increase, or if you increase the amplitude. But this is a really simple, you know, schematic. But there's a lot of things that make this much more complicated. So one is, you know, in the winter you've got snow, and snow acts as a very good insulator, but it's only there during the winter. And so that acts to warm the soil relative to the atmosphere, because you've got this good insulator, you know, big blanket in the winter that keeps you warm, but then it disappears in the summer. Similarly, you've got pretty complicated heat exchange with the atmosphere. So, you know, in the winter, you've got a very stably stratified atmosphere, so it inhibits heat exchange. And in the summer, it's more likely to be turbulent, where you'll have better heat exchange. And so those dynamics are also very complex and represented very differently in different climate models. And then you've got questions about, well, you know, what is the soil material? Is, you know, you've got organic peaty materials that have very low heat conductivity but very high porosity, and versus mineral soils which are higher conductivity and lower porosity. And so, in general, it actually turns out to be a much more complicated question of how the soil thermal regime, you know, interacts with climate. So one question you can say is, well, do the climate models that exist, and here we've got four representatives from the next phase of the IPCC. Each IPCC report involves a big coupled climate model in a comparison project. And so right now I've taken data from CMIP-5, which is the most recent assemblage of climate models that is sort of being released right now. And and saying, okay, well, if you look at the temperature dynamics and you say, well, which grid cells have a layer that stays frozen all year? And we'll say a layer within the top 3 meters or 5 meters, somewhere in that range. Call that our near-surface permafrost. And if we look at those climate models and compare that with observations, do the models do a reasonable job of simulating where the permafrost is? And so one thing is, in reality, you've got a whole gradient of, from continuous to sporadic and isolated permafrost. The models can't do that. They're just working at, single grid cells. So each grid cell either is or is not permafrost. And so you either have continuous or nothing. And another thing to look at here is, so the black line, which unfortunately you can't really see very well, is the 0 degree isotherm in the air temperature. And so you might expect, okay, well, the permafrost maybe lines up more or less, permafrost boundary lines up more or less with where the 0 degree isotherm is. But it's actually more complex than that, because in general, the continuous permafrost is quite a bit, covers a much smaller area than the 0 degree air. And the reason for that is the snow thermal insulation and things like that that make the soils generally warmer than the air. And so one question is, are the models doing a decent job of that? And there's a range of them. Some models like the HAD-GEM, the permafrost extent and the 0 degree isotherm line up perfectly well. So you don't have any of that effect. Other models have sort of two warm soils, and some of them, like CCSM4, is probably doing a reasonably good job in terms of the soil temperature. Another question is, what about the active layer thickness? And here's a map of what the active layer thicknesses looks like. So basically, you start with fairly thin active layers, and they get much, even where you still have permafrost going forward, you have much deeper active layers. And so as a result, you've transferred a lot of soil from what was in the permafrost, and now it's in the active layer. Another paper by Dave Lawrence and colleagues using a different model show, similar thing, where you have this, pretty dramatic drop in the active layer, or in the extent of permafrost with warming, and this is a crucial point that the extent of warming actually really matters here. So in this RCP 8.5, which is a pretty extreme warming case, you end up losing the majority of permafrost within this century, at least in the near surface, down to 3 meters. There's still permafrost still below that, because it takes a little while for the thaw to propagate downwards below the near surface. Before I showed a couple papers, now, what do all the models show? And one of the values of this is that you're sampling a range of different things. The total amount of warming, the total warming at high latitudes versus low latitudes, the communication of that warming from the air to the land surface. And what you see is that, in this RCP 4.5, which is moderate warming, ending with about 500 ppm by 2100, you see a significant loss of permafrost, somewhere in the range of between 20 and say 50% of permafrost lost based on these models. And there's some outliers. And one of the things we're doing right now is trying to develop a real set of metrics in order to throw out the models that aren't doing a good job. And so, one way you can say is the ones that predict really low permafrost to begin with or really high permafrost to begin with, they're probably doing something wrong. Similarly, if the active layer distribution is not at all reasonable, the model is probably doing something wrong. And so if you look at the models that get things more or less right for current conditions, those models, all tend to be kind of clumped in the center of these distributions. So in this RCP 8.5 scenario, you end up with somewhere in the range of 60 to 80% permafrost loss by 2100 in these surface layers. So it's not just the couple models that have been used to publish this. It seems to be a pretty robust response for a lot of these models. And so if you think about it in terms of a distribution function, a cumulative distribution function of what the active layer thickness looks like, so if this is, here's depth here, and if at some depth, say a meter, you say, what's the chance of being in permafrost versus in the active layer? And so what the model is predicting is that at a meter, currently you've got about a 40% chance of being in permafrost and a 60% chance of being in the active layer. Well, as you warm up, the lines move to the right. So now you're, by 2100, even under this moderate warming scenario, you've gone, at that same depth, you've gone to about a 20%. So you've lost, you've essentially doubled the probability of being in the active layer. You expect the total amount of carbon to be not necessarily least, but vulnerable to thawing, to be proportional to the thickness of this change. Right? So at the surface, you're already pretty much starting out in the active layer. So you're not really very sensible to changes in the active layer thickness at the surface. Whereas depth, you're starting off almost entirely in the permafrost. And so any change in the permafrost extent corresponds to a change in the total amount of carbon that's now vulnerable. And again, so in this RCP 8.5, which is much more severe warming, you end up with much more significant movement of carbon from permafrost to the active layers. So now we've looked at what the models are predicting for the temperature response. And the next question is, can we compare that to observations of what the vertical profiles of soil carbon look like and how much carbon you expect to be vulnerable to thaw as a result of this warming? So this is some work that a lot of people have been contributing to, which creates a representative carbon profiles for different types of soil. So here we've got the same three types of soils that Charles and Luca were talking about before. So we've got histels, which are frozen peat soils, orthels, which are not peat, they're mineral soils, but they're not cryoturbated, and you've got turbels, which are cryoturbated mineral soils. And so you've got depth down to about 2.5 meters here.
We are listening to excerpts from a speech by Charles Coven of Berkeley National Labs. He is developing the latest scientific assessments on the impact of permafrost thaw on the world's climate. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with expert answers to the question, what happens if the permafrost thaws? Following our opening interview with Canada's Antony Levkovich, we're hearing from Dr. Charles Coven, a climate expert from the Earth Sciences Division of the Berkeley National Lab in California. Our recording comes from the AAAS meeting in Vancouver, February 2012.
The point is you can then add up all this carbon and say, okay, well, something like 1,700 petagrams of carbon, but with a really wide range, somewhere between 500 as a minimum estimate and 3,000 as a maximum estimate. The range is just based on the standard deviation of all these soil profiles is there. And of that, maybe 950 is actually in these permafrost layers. And then as you warm, how much of it gets released? So under the most extreme warming scenario, potentially to 700 petagrams is now vulnerable to thaw. With a large range, between 250 and 1,200 petagrams of carbon is now been thawed, which is different. It has not necessarily ended up in the atmosphere yet, but now it's been thawed and is now more vulnerable than it was before to decomposition. That gives you an estimate of what the total change in carbon might be, or what the total amounts of vulnerable carbon as a result of warming might be. But there's no real ability to say, okay, well, how does that actually end up in the atmosphere? What are the rates of it going into the atmosphere? In order to actually get that, one way to do it is take sort of the standard soil model that people have been using in land surface models, which is basically these box models, and you say, okay, We'll put some of the carbon in these different pools and assign a time scale that it stays in the pool for these different time scales. And so typically people haven't ever thought about what's the depth distribution of the soil carbon. But for the permafrost, that ends up being critical. So instead of taking this box modeling approach, you distribute the soil carbon vertically, give it a clear vertical distribution of what the soil is. And then as you change the temperature and moisture environment of the soils with warming, then the carbon would respond appropriately. So as this layer is thaws, it's no longer in the permafrost, and so now the carbon that's in here will see a different residence time than it did before. But the first question is, somebody have to get the carbon down there, right? Because the plants don't really have roots in the permafrost. So the plants, the leaves and roots turn over all in the active layer. And so you have to include this very slow mixing process from the active layer down into the permafrost in order to get that. And so, there's a sort of a long history in climate models of representing turbulent processes, which, one way of thinking about this cryoturbation is this is a very slow, turbulent mixing. It's just a straight diffusive process with a very slow time scale. And if you do that, then you end up with, it's going from a vertical distribution of carbon that looks like something like this, to something where you're now mixing the carbon down deeper into the permafrost. And so you've got more carbon that's vulnerable should the temperature environment at depth change. And what that looks like in terms of the map is, without any mixing, you don't have much carbon in the permafrost. And with mixing, you end up with a lot more carbon in the permafrost. We're still probably underestimating the carbon relative to the observations, particularly because we're not representing this anoxic peat accumulation process as yet. That's something that we're working on, but is not incorporated in the model yet. And so we're really looking more at these mineral soils. And if you then take that model and run it through this warming experiment, and so the blue line is control, which is sort of like the C4 MIP results that I showed in my first slide, not much of a response. The loss of carbon from the soil is basically canceled out by the gain of carbon because of increased vegetation productivity. And this orange line, which includes all these permafrost processes, you change it to something like a 60 petagram carbon loss from the soils into the atmosphere with warming. And so, yeah, this is actually a pretty important process that you want to be able to capture in these models if you, in terms of understanding how the total feedback process works between the atmosphere and the land surface. And then another question that always comes up with this is, well, what happens with the methane? And at least in the model we developed, the methane response is actually quite a bit smaller than the total carbon process. And one of the reasons for that is that the methane is constantly cycling anyway. And so there's these methane emissions just from natural wetlands at high latitude. And so as you thaw the carbon, the deep stuff, it already is pretty slow to turn over. When there's no oxygen available, it turns over even in order of magnitude slower than that already. And so at least on the sort of 100-year time, timescale, it seems like that carbon might not come out as this catastrophic methane burst that you read about in the newspaper, but it's more like another term, but much smaller, especially in terms of its radiative impact. One of the things to know here is that in terms of the radiative impact of methane, or you often read this number of 25, to, you know, methane 25 times more powerful greenhouse gas than CO2, right? So if you actually look at what the definition of that number is, 25 is in kilograms of methane divided by the kilograms of CO2. But you know, when you take carbon, the soil, and you make it CO2 versus methane, those two oxygen atoms actually weigh a lot, right? So the molecular weight of CO2 is 44 versus, you know, molecular weight of 16 for methane. So you actually have to do that correction. And so you end up not with a 25 times more powerful greenhouse gas on a mole per mole basis, but a 9 times more powerful. So it's still important. But because the turnover in these anoxic systems is an order of magnitude less, it ends up kind of canceling each other out. So you've a more powerful greenhouse gas, but it comes out much slower. And so the CO2 ends up being a much larger impact in terms of the total effect on the climate. Some conclusions. And so, you know, I put up the Wile E. Coyote here because basically get across this idea that one of the interesting aspects of this problem is that by the time we get to the point where this matters, there's this huge delay, right? You have this warming, and the warming, you know, takes a long time for that warming to propagate into the soil. And then it takes a long time for that, particularly in terms of the permafrost, then it has to come out, you know, you then start slowly decomposing this carbon, and it lasts for a really long time. And so it's not this sort of direct feedback response, it's this really long delay. And so it's, you know, it's a little bit like Wile E. Coyote. You know, not to say that, you know, the permafrost is going to be the thing that, you know, leads to global catastrophe, because it's, you know, it's a term, but it's not the end of the planet or something like that. But it does have this built-in delay. And so, you know, if we get to the point where we start really seeing the permafrost thawing in a big way, you know, in a sense, it's we've gone off the cliff already. Basically, so, you know, what are some take-homes of how this might actually play out? So one thing is in terms of the total loss of permafrost, right? So it matters a lot between these sort of moderate warming scenarios and high warming scenarios, where, you know, with high warming, you can really, you know, lose the vast majority of permafrost, whereas with moderate warming, there'll still be quite a bit of permafrost left, at least by 2100. And then, you know, the total amount of carbon that might be coming out, somewhere in the range of 50 to 100 petagrams of carbon, probably actually I should draw the error bars wider than that, because we really, you know, our confidence is pretty low on what this number is. But it's a, you know, it's a globally relevant number. So that's between 25 and 50 ppm CO2 increase. So that's, you know, it's equivalent to 10 or 20 years of CO2 increase at current rate. So it's not a nothing. It's, you know, it's a significant thing. On the other hand, it's not equal to an extra 100 years of CO2 emissions, right? It increases the total sensitivity of the planet by, you know, somewhere in the 10 to 20% range. Another thing is that the CO2 is much more important than methane in terms of the total radiative forcing response, at least using the mechanisms that we're including here, which do not include things like, you know, methane hydrate clathrates that, as Charles said, are much deeper in the soil, and so you expect to have happen much slower. The total amount of carbon that's going to be thawed is, you know, potentially much larger than what we're predicting to actually end up in the atmosphere. So this could continue for a very long time. You know, once the thaw happens, then you have this very, very long tail of carbon being emitted from these soils, and they could go on for a very long time. So, you know, what are some next steps? You know, one crucial thing here is we've essentially completely neglected any of these small-scale processes, things like thaw lakes, wetland dynamics and linkages to river networks. And so there's a really big push to link these fine-scale processes into the global models. And so, like, for example, the DOE has a new project, NG, which is really focused on this question of what are small-scale processes and how do those impact the larger scale. Another thing that we're trying to wrestle with right now is what are the nutrient dynamics and feedbacks between the vegetation and soil? So as you release this carbon and mineralize it, you also mineralize a lot of nitrogen, which could stimulate plant productivity and act as a negative feedback. You know, and there are more complex vegetation feedbacks. For example, with fire, you know, if you change the vegetation type, you could increase the fire frequency and change the dynamics that way. So there's a lot more really complex dynamics that are not being represented yet that we're trying to sort of wrestle with.
That was Dr. Charles Coven from the Berkeley National Labs from the National Academy for the Advancement of Science presentation, What If the Permafrost Thaws? That was February 19, 2012. You can get a full recording of the event with Coven, moderator Luca Montanarella of the European Union, and the highly regarded Canadian expert Charles Tarnakai as an MP3 download. That costs you $20 from avn.com. That's AVEN.com. Look for recording number AS2019. Find more links in my Radio EcoShock blog for this program at ecoshock.info. That's ecoshock.info. Or you can listen again to the show and pass it around as a free MP3 from our program archives at ecoshock.org. Should we worry about the permafrost thaw? Maybe not today or tomorrow. The big thaw is happening slowly. It will define the history of the planet. As the Russian expert Sergei Kropotkin of Tomsk University says, the process is already underway. We can delay it with smarter energy choices and greenhouse gas control, but unless a miracle happens, over the next century or three, planet Earth will thaw. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. I appreciate your patience and your brain power. Thank you for caring about your world.
But when an expert says it's a problem, and makes a movie about the problem, and wins an Oscar about the problem, and gets the Nobel Prize about the problem, then all the other experts have to agree. It is most likely a problem. 'Cause only an expert can deal with the problem.